Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, Carol Joffe will be talking about how the stigma against abortion creates real problems for women and providers. Also, Operation Rescue shows how anti-life they really are, and looking at the question of whether or not pregnant teenagers should be allowed to play sports. The National Women's Law Center has definitely picked up on the fact that right-wing anti-choicers sure do love to speak in code, and so they put together a video translating some of Bart Stupak's comments to explain what he really means.
No one should be forced to have an abortion.
Translation, and no one should be allowed to have one either.
We cannot support any healthcare reform proposal unless it explicitly excludes abortion from the scope of any government-defined or subsidized healthcare plan.
Translation, it should be impossible for anyone to get insurance that covers abortion.
Legislation as important as this, abortion must be addressed clearly in the legislation.
Translation, I can't repeal Roe v. Wade, but I can do the next best thing, get rid of abortion coverage and healthcare reform.
The fight is far from over. Pick up the phone and call your representative and tell them to do whatever they can to keep abortion restrictions out of the final bill. I usually have nothing but sympathy for people that Operation Rescue decides to make targets. Operation Rescue and other confrontational anti-choice organizations enjoy hostility for its own sake and mainly use abortion as an excuse to act belligerent on whoever their leaders tell them is an acceptable target. But I have mixed feelings about this video where Operation Rescue decided to unleash on Senator Bob Casey, a Pennsylvania Democrat who is anti-abortion but pro-healthcare.
Excuse me, do not trust this man. He's funded abortion in other countries, China, Africa, and America. You can't feed the hungry if you kill them. Why are you killing children, sir? You betrayed the pro-life cause. You betrayed children.
Of course, what this guy is yelling is complete nonsense. Like most anti-choice fanatics, the confrontation and the glow of being a mean person under the guise of self-righteousness is the only thing that matters. Facts are irrelevant. I have no idea what he's even trying to refer to, since the U.S. hasn't funded abortion services overseas in God only knows how long. Of course, we are talking about Operation Rescue. They probably think condoms are abortion. I'm sure they're convinced Casey isn't nearly enough of a sex-phobic misogynist. The press release Randall Terry sent out with this video was heavy with language intended to make people who are grossed out by sex freak out. He suggested that Casey is seducing audiences with boilerplate politician speeches. I really don't like seeing anyone ambushed by a bunch of dishonest kooks, even though Bob Casey is a maddening anti-choice politician. And yet, I hoped that this confrontation was educational for Casey and his supporters. See, I think a lot of anti-abortion folks with otherwise liberal leanings are under the mistaken impression that the anti-choice movement is composed of sincere people who are truly concerned about life. But you can just hear their screeching to see the flaws in that hope.
To give to a child and you want them to kill their baby before they're born.
He would have definitely
happened if you had killed your children before they were born.
And
if you cared about your children, he would have said, kill those babies.
Ladies and gentlemen,
you are a pro-life hypocrite.
Mothers, you don't care about children.
Who the hell knows what they're screeching about? Terry's press release obscures it, probably because he's scared to give his followers too much information, or maybe because he just made all this up. But whatever it is, the reason that Operation Rescue has made Casey a target is they don't like that he supports measures that will save human lives, especially healthcare reform. Though, from their screeching, it also appears they are opposed to any healthcare spending overseas that would save lives. For people who claim they're pro-life, they sure are hell-bent on making sure that the maximum number of people in this world die from lack of basic health care. Though, of course, they have a special love of attacking basic healthcare to save women's lives. Nothing gets them more riled up than the possibility that our government might spend money that results in fewer women dying around the world due to preventable reproductive health problems and unsafe childbirth. Luckily, despite the screeching opposition to doing anything that might improve the lives of women and children here and abroad, there seems to be more political momentum in that direction. As I'm sure you know, Hillary Clinton gave a wonderful speech about the importance of these issues worldwide at the International Conference on Population and Development.
All governments will make access to reproductive health care and family planning services a basic right. We will dramatically reduce infant, child, and maternal mortality. We will open the doors of education to all citizens, but especially to girls and women. It is somewhat hard to believe, in retrospect, that Cairo was the first ever global forum that recognized the connection between women's health, the quality of women's lives, and human progress on a broader scale.
Now, of course, the reality of this is all undeniable to all thinking people, that contraception, abortion, and general health care that anti-choicers object to are life-saving. Life is preserved if women are able to control when they give birth. Life is preserved if women and girls are educated and can make more money to lift them out of poverty. Duh! So let's hope that folks like Bob Casey realize that when anti-choicers object to measures to improve women's lives and health, they are against life, no matter what they call themselves. I'd like to welcome Carol Jaffe to the program. Carol is a frequent contributor to RH Reality Check, as I'm sure you know, and a professor of sociology at the University of California, Davis, and a researcher at the Bixby Center for Reproductive Health Research and Policy at the University of California, San Francisco. She's got a new book out called Dispatches from the Abortion Wars, The Cost of Fanaticism to Doctors, Patients, and the Rest of Us. And she's here today to talk about her book. Welcome to RealityCast, Carol.
Thank you.
The moderate pro-choice mantra has always been safe, legal, and rare, or at least for the past 20 years or so. And I would say that that phrase contains an argument. And that argument is that we can stigmatize abortion while not harming women's health. But you disagree in this book. Why?
Well, I think safe, I mean, I understand where safe, legal, and rare comes from. I think it was an attempt to reach out across the aisle, so to speak, or at least across a divide. The problem with safe, legal, and rare, I mean, there's really two problems. You know, one is it inevitably makes those who are getting the abortions, the rare people, or those who are performing them, somewhat suspect. The other thing, and I have a colleague at the University of California, at San Francisco, who has done excellent work on this, rare simply isn't realistic. If you take the number of women of reproductive age and you use the estimates given of contraceptive failure, even with quite correct usage, there's just too many people, too many sexually active people of reproductive age to make rare realistic. Now, having said that, there are many in the abortion-providing world, and I agree with them, that the real problem is not how many abortions take place. The real problem is that in 2010, 50 years after the introduction of, you know, of the best contraceptive method known, namely the pill, the United States still has an extremely high rate of unplanned pregnancy, some of which end up being unwanted, some of which don't. So, in fact, abortion providers, as a part of the standard of care in most clinics, is to discuss with the patient contraception. Abortion providers believe that a better public health practice is to prevent pregnancies in the first place if, in fact, you don't want them.
So a lot of the book focuses on stigma and how abortion has been stigmatized. Can you talk a little bit about how bad this situation has gotten as far as just the cultural stigma of abortion?
That's a good question, and it's almost hard to parody. In the book, I give examples of people whose very incidental connection with abortion stigmatize them, people and institutions. For example, in Texas, several years ago, there was a boycott called against the Girl Scout cookie sale. Now, what could be more apolitical than Girl Scouts selling cookies? The reason that this Girl Scout troop had done a project with Planned Parenthood that had nothing to do with abortion, but because they had, you know, associated with the devil, therefore we should not have, you know, we should not buy their cookies. Perhaps the most ludicrous example, which again you couldn't make up, was when Barack Obama was, during the period of the inauguration, Christy, and I'm not making this up, Christy Kreme Donuts announced that people could come into their stores and get a donut of their choice to celebrate the new president. I mean, the Christy Kreme Donuts was simply trying to have a tie-in to this big event. One of the leading anti-abortion groups went crazy, sent out press releases saying, boycott Krispy Kreme donuts. They are, you know, capitalizing on the fact that we have the most pro-choice president ever, and if you get their donuts of their choice, you are supporting choice, namely abortion. And again, I assure your listeners that I didn't make that up.
Obviously, the effects are awful. About a third of women will have an abortion at some point in their life. And there's this huge stigma attached to it. Can you talk about what this does to the patients, to the women who've had abortions?
You know, is that our society, and you, Amanda, have written very eloquently about this, you know, our society, namely the United States, has issues with sexuality. I mean, on one hand, we're a sexually saturated society, you know, five-year-olds wearing thongs and having makeover parties. You know, on the other hand, we are a deeply puritanical society. I mean, certainly compared to Western European countries that have a much, much lower rates of both abortion and unplanned pregnancies, what they have is realistic, age-appropriate sex education. With respect to your question of, you know, what the stigma does to women, it makes them feel bad when they shouldn't have to feel bad. It's very, very interesting to sort of think about the whole stigma issue along parallel tracks from both a sociological perspective as well as a psychological one. Now, the anti-abortion movement has relentlessly pushed the idea for the last 20 years or so that there's this mental illness called post-abortion syndrome, and that women who get abortions are more at risk for various kinds of mental health than other women. This has been disproved again and again. The president of the American Psychiatric Association, Dr. Neda Stotland, has said this is a made-up disease. It doesn't exist anywhere in the literature. Probably the best pronouncement on the connection between mental health and abortion was made a few years ago in an article by some psychologists who said the best prediction for a woman's mental health after an abortion is the status of her mental health before an abortion, which strikes me as very sound reasoning. At the same, in other words, the idea that abortion causes serious or even unserious mental health issues is a myth. At the same time, you know, we live in a society, as you're pointing out, that's where abortion is deeply stigmatized. What it does is give women unnecessary feelings of shame, puts enormous pressures on them to hide the fact of their abortion from others. I mean, if you are outed as someone who has an abortion, it can have serious consequences. You know, think back, I mean, we see this in celebrities all the time. Think back to Sarah Palin and the period in which it became clear that her daughter was having an unwed, was pregnant but not being married. If her daughter had chosen to have an abortion, you know, Sarah Palin would not have been able to run for office. That would have discredited her. But it's not just celebrities who fear revelations of abortions. Now, as our society is debating what health care reform should be and whether it should include insurance plans that cover for abortion, which I think it should, at the same time, I mean, what's very sad is that at the same time, some women who have insurance coverage under, who have abortion coverage under insurance plans don't use it. They don't want a paper trail. So in many different kinds of ways, the stigma surrounding abortion unfairly affects a lot of women. I think the most severe consequence of this stigma is the fact that access is chronically so difficult for many women, you know, once you're outside of the major metropolitan areas on each coast.
How does stigma, the stigma of abortion, how is it affecting access itself?
Well, what I talk about in the book is that most people within the medical field are not against abortion. I mean, from every bit of data we have. So, for example, doctors, healthcare providers, they, especially the ones who are now in their 60s and older, they know what happens when abortion isn't legal. They know women will still want to get abortions. They know they'll go to very dangerous lengths. So the medical profession as a whole is actually more supportive of legal abortion than the population as a whole. The problem is the medical profession doesn't like controversy. I mean, most professions don't, but they really are conflict averse. So what I've noticed in the research I've done that I've reported in my book is that in fact training of abortion providers has actually improved somewhat over the last few years. It's not as routinized as we would, those of us who are supportive of abortion rights would like it to be, but it has improved immeasurably, in large part because of the enormous efforts of many organizations within medicine. So if you don't get abortion training in your residency, you can get it through organizations. You can either go to Planned Parenthood Clinic or an organization like PERCH, Physicians for Reproductive Choice and Health, will do some training, or the National Abortion Federation. The problem is when it comes to integrating abortion services or even training in a hospital setting, what you see is not moral opposition to abortion. You see is tremendous fear of controversy. So you see a hospital administrator or a department chair saying, look, I'm not against abortion, but the minute those pickets show up, the deal's off. You know, I don't want pickets here. I don't want crazy people here. I don't want television cameras here. You know, so you see this censoring because of the fear of controversy that may or may not even emerge. You know, and that's deeply frustrating. I have a young colleague at UCSF whose name is Lori Friedman, a brilliant sociologist. She has a new book coming out in several months that I hope, Amanda, you'll do a podcast about. And it's called Wheeling and Unable. And it's really a wonderful study. It's a study, I mean, it's depressing, but it's wonderfully important. She interviewed about 40 doctors who had been trained in abortion and who wanted to provide abortion. And she actually documents the difficulties they faced in establishing themselves professionally in a place where abortions could take place. And remember, these are pro-choice people. They sought out abortion training. In some cases, it's because of so many hospitals being merged, so many secular hospitals being merged with Catholic ones. I mean, that's a big trend going on in our society, and that has a real impact, obviously, not only for abortion, but other contraceptive services. So in some cases, it was hospital policy. Most disturbing to me, or most depressing to me, in other cases, it was doctors who were signing up as junior people in group practices. They were told you have to sign a contract saying you will not provide abortions. You will not provide abortions even off-site. Now, this was not because of necessarily moral opposition to abortion. This was because people in group practices, the senior partners, many of whom were older and more conservative, although not necessarily so, simply did not want controversy. They did not want their practices being picketed. They did not want angry letters. They did not want they did not want attention for the fact that someone in their practice did this procedure. So that's where I see the most insidious workings of this stigma.
My guest today has been Carol Joffe. Her book is called Dispatches from the Abortion Wars, The Cost of Fanaticism to Doctors, Patients, and the Rest of Us. It's published by Beacon Press and widely available. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Carol.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
This next bit is based on an interesting story in light of the discussion about how abortion is stigmatized, because, as Carol said, that stigma is rooted in hostility to sex. How do I know? Because if you don't get an abortion in some cases, that's just as stigmatized.
We have a big question for you here. Teenage women, should they be allowed to play sports? Wait. If they're pregnant, this is a question dividing a Texas high school, forcing athletic programs around the country to face some tough questions. Now,
if we leave out the issues of misogyny and hostility towards human sexuality, then it seems that the answer is straightforward. Is it dangerous? The notion that pregnant women are withering flowers is something that's lost a lot of ground in recent years. I can't see that it's more dangerous for a pregnant woman to play volleyball than any woman. Volleyball carries the high risk of breaking a leg or an arm, after all, and so if you think a miscarriage is somehow a greater risk than that, it's because you're othering the pregnant woman or insinuating that the fetus matters more than the health of all teenage girls. In this case, I'd say that the school's official policy of requiring a doctor's note is enough of a hurdle to cross. Pregnancy should be no more or no less an issue than any other medical condition. The girl in question achieved that standard.
Dr. Jay Hurd examined McKenzie and gave her permission to play with some conditions. But the Fort Worth School District officials sent McKenzie's mother a letter saying they were unable to accommodate the need to monitor her heart rate and physical contact is inherent in this sport. McKenzie was still off the team. 3 days later, Dr. Hurd had his nurse write a second note saying McKenzie can continue to play volleyball at this time with no restrictions. That note cleared McKenzie to play the next day.
At this point, unless you're trying to stigmatize the young woman for having a sexuality or having a female body, that should be the end of it, right? Especially since this is a conservative part of the country, she probably would have gotten even more abuse if she was known to have an abortion, leaving her with no choices at all. But of course, this was not the end of the story, and the fact that this is about sexual shaming becomes way more obvious.
However, during her absence, McKenzie was told that head coach Jack Warren had taken it upon himself to inform the team that she was pregnant. And McKenzie says her anguish was compounded when Coach Warren reduced her playing time.
He told me that he always does this before people move up and before the seniors leave. And then I looked on the court and everyone else was still there. I felt like this was the one thing that I could count on to... And that everything would be okay and everything would work out, and then that too was taken away, so it made me feel like I was kind of left with nothing to really count on.
The comments at ABC really reinforced the fact that pregnancy is, whether you have the baby or not, basically an opportunity for the public and authorities to shame women for being both female and being sexual. Third comment in, someone in all caps says, "There are teens in high school that do not have sex. You live with the consequences of your actions." End quote. I would like to point out that no young man who gets a young woman pregnant is eligible for this level of faux concern over his health that translates into the open shaming and exclusion. And it's always funny to me how people who say things like this ignore the fact that humanity has invented effective contraception, and if people like them didn't go out of their way to keep kids from getting to it, this wouldn't be a problem. Another commenter said, quote, "Seriously, what are the parents thinking, and are they thinking at all? Grow up, little girl," end quote. What do they mean by grow up? Does growing up for a woman mean having to choose between being sexual and getting to be part of a larger community? Does growing up mean that you have to give in to the idea that being a mother means the end of having any parts of your life that are for yourself? And one final comment from the religious peanut gallery. Quote, "Entitled brats like this chick aggravate the bejeebers out of me. She brings up God and faith as an excuse for not getting an abortion. Was she on break from being a good Christian when she was having premarital sex? How very convenient," end quote. And to bring it all around, the point was never about life, but about sex. An abortion is offensive to the right because it gives women an opportunity to keep their private lives private, away from the prying eyes of judgmental prigs. And now for the Wisdom of Wingnuts, Worse Than You Thought edition. Last week, I reported on how anti-gay activist Scott Lively was being cagily supportive of Uganda's proposal to punish homosexuality with severe prison sentences and maybe even the death penalty. Now, more video of the presentation he did at the Ugandan conference that kicked all this off has come out. This is him talking about gay men.
These are men who don't have anything involved in. They are so far from normalcy that they're killers. They're serial killers, mass murderers. They're people, they're sociopaths, right? There's no mercy at all. There's no nurturing. There's no caring about anybody else. This is the kind of person that it takes to run a gas chain, right? Or to do a mass murder, you know, like this, the Rwandan stuff, probably involve these guys.
The fact that he brings up the Rwandan genocide in Uganda, which borders Rwanda, shows how, far from being the innocents they pretend they are, the anti-gay activists are in fact deliberately engaging the most unimaginable slanders in order to drum up hate against gay people.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.